But we don't have one, so we had to improvise.
But you never told me the signal, Alder exclaimed. Then he winced as realization settled in. Oh, no. Sorry, man, Ed told him. I need to ask the vampire some questions about the heroes, so... I may need to hang on inside your mind for a bit while Kes guards my body in the chapel. Don't worry, I'll leave you in full control. I'll only be listening and telling you what questions to ask. Think of it as your own personal advisor hanging out inside your head. Back on Earth, people paid good money for that kind of remote support. Alder had the kind of face that couldn't hide his true emotions unless he was actively playing a part. He glanced down, bit his lip, fidgeted with his hands, and said,
No way. No way in hell I'll be vampire bait. There's nothing you can do to convince me, so just forget about it.
I just want to make it officially known that this sets a bad precedent for bards everywhere, Alder said quietly.
He stood alone in the middle of the chamber, only a few feet away from the coffin and the magical circle that was the only thing protecting him from the creature inside.
What we're supposed to do is watch from afar, preserving events for posterity. Not as a juicy vampire midnight snack.
Ed's voice came straight from inside Alder's head. You don't care about impersonating me with the Thieves Guild?
That's different, Alder said.
Speaking to Ed felt vaguely like speaking to himself, in an entirely concerning way.
I can use that to flirt with all the sexy, leather-clad thieves of the guild, which is a sacred bardic duty. A hard job, often dangerous, that I must uphold nevertheless.
Ed's amusement flashed down Alder's body much like it had been his own, mingling with Alder's wounded pride. In fact, if they weren't careful, thoughts and emotions could mix, making it hard to figure out where it had come from. Alder thought of it like being in a very cramped sauna back-to-back with another man, both trying their best to keep their privacy to themselves.
It's not so bad, the dungeon lord told him. If your mind is a house, I'm in the basement right now, looking out through a window. As long as I don't pry inside a drawer or a broom closet, I won't stumble across your private diary or anything like that.
That's actually good to know, Alder said.
Of course. There was no way for me not to see that garden filled with nude statues of Yorche's daughters. I wonder what he'd have to say about it.
Ah, go on, make fun of the poor bard,
Alder said, frowning. Then he raised an eyebrow.
There isn't... You wouldn't tell Yorche anyway, would you?
He chuckled aloud, because Ed was chuckling in the basement. Alder wondered how long it would take to go insane if they kept going like this. He distractedly caressed the silver bits of his new shiny necklace. The smell of garlic rose to his nostrils. He wasn't unarmed. Quite the opposite, in fact. He carried his sword, his flute, a bag with Levy's runes, and a pair of blessed silver-tipped stakes that the Cuffdar had given him. And Kes was in the next room, with a cadre of monster hunters ready to spring into action should anything happen. Of course, a vampire could rip his throat out before anyone had time to react at all.
Don't think about that, he chided himself. How much longer do we have to wait?
He asked aloud. Technically, he could just think at Ed and it would be faster, but Alder felt more comfortable this way.
Not much longer. It's dark outside. If our vampire wasn't destroyed when we damaged the coffin, we should meet him soon.
And as if the creature had heard Ed's thoughts, the light of all the magical torches in the room dimmed. A rush of cold air, almost freezing, seeped through Alder's clothing. It reminded him of Nikolai's wraith. He shivered, but not because of the cold. A hollow knock came from inside the coffin, and the heavy wooden lid began to creak open.
Here we go,
Alder said with a small voice. Along with his fear came a rush of furious clarity. It was easy for Alder to tell that he wasn't the source of this sensation. His fear screamed at him to run away as fast as possible from the monster. Ed's instincts, on the other hand, clamored like the clarion's call for the pointed sword at Alder's side, in case he needed to tear out the vampire's throat before it had the chance to attack.
"So, this is what it feels like to be a dungeon lord,"
Alder mused. Even when in danger, a dungeon lord was a predator. Never prey. The vampire probably felt the same way. "Focus," Ed thought at him. "It's coming." Alder reached for his sword and slid an inch of steel out of the scabbard. Another crack came from the lid's iron hinges, and the slab rose an inch away from the coffin. A dirty mist flowed out of the dark interior and poured into the stone floor and up onto the chamber like a spectral waterfall. Slowly, the lid rose another inch. Alder had the strange sensation that the creature was having a hard time dealing with the lid's weight. But that was impossible. Levy had been very clear that nightshades were inhumanly strong. And besides, why would a vampire sleep in a coffin it could barely get out of? More likely, the undead monster was toying with him, lulling him into a false sense of security, perhaps. He drew his sword another inch and noted that the mist remained contained inside the limits of the magical circle. That, at least, was encouraging. An air of humidity and old dust fought for dominance with the smell of garlic in Alder's nostrils. A humanoid silhouette half-emerged and half-materialized from inside the coffin, obscured by the mist, as an invisible current siphoned the mist into the coffin, as if swallowed by a gigantic lung. Alder raised the lens that Zachary had fashioned and held it right in front of him. He kept his gaze focused on the slightly distorted vision of the glass.
"Ah, is it you, Yaraz?"
asked a woman's raspy voice.
"I'm not going to lie, darling. I thought we were goners this time. May murmur, damn the militant church."
There was a sharp movement from inside the mist, like a head turning sharply.
"Wait, you are not Yaraz."
Long, curly hair flowed in the non-existent breeze, golden like a sunshine but without its warmth. Alder caught glimpses of gray, wax-like skin pulled tight over sharp bones, and of a black funeral dress that could have been worn by a Lothian noble 100 years ago, but was now ragged and with sleeves half-eaten by moths. A black sash hugged a slender waist, and a small, elegant hat full with flowery laces covered the golden curls that framed the scowling face of the corpse.
"Who dares breach the sanctity of my tomb?"
the vampire asked, still half hidden by the mist.
"Know that you've forsaken your blood for this transgression, mortal."
Her voice was raspy, faint, and dreadful like a whisper in a graveyard. Something about the challenge and threat in her voice awoke an instinctive fury inside Ed that burned in Alder's mind like the explosion of a fireball, as if his bones and his veins were white-hot with violent, dark magical power, and before the bard could even realize what was going on inside his body, he was standing as tall as he could, his back straight like an iron rod and lips curled in a regal scowl.
"I dare,"
he exclaimed. Ed speaking through him with a dungeon lord's authority. Green heat shone out of Alder's eyes for an instant, showering the vampire in light and shadow. The creature growled like a beast and stepped back, her arms spread in an animalistic fashion to protect the coffin behind her.
"Dungeon lord!"
Her fangs gleamed under the afterglow of the evil eye, pearly white and sharp like needles. Alder was acutely aware that he was caught between two powerful beings of the dark squaring up, recognizing and sizing each other up all at once, like a pair of bucks crossing antlers in Elytra's forests, or two bards exchanging drunken quips in a tavern. Except that these two were much more dangerous than a drunken bard or a horny deer. Alder wondered if it was a good moment to cast nimble feet and make himself scarce. And then the mist cleared, and a fact that had been nagging at a small part of his brain was now in full display, and the part of his brain that was too distracted by fear couldn't ignore it anymore. Ed thought, confusion smacking the teeth out of his anger as he saw through Alder's eyes.
Alder
agreed. He blinked and scratched his chin.
"Ain't that something?"
he said. The vampire frowned with indignation, as if she couldn't believe that Alder and Ed had dared break the dark tension between them.
What's the matter?
She asked in her archaic wording. Then her frown deepened. Her red eyes traveled down Alder's body, all the way to his feet, and then upwards, all the way up into his eyes. She had to throw her head back for that. A look of dismay replaced the frown.
Dungeon Lord, are you perhaps possessing the body of a giant to confront me?
I'm afraid not,
Alder told the creature, who was in the shape of a 10-year-old dead girl. The vampire sighed and turned to her coffin. She passed her small hand across the cracked web on the center of the lid.
Dunghill,
she hissed. The vampire's name was Yarlan. She had been Lord Uras's right hand for about a year, but at some point before that, she'd also served under his grandfather's reign. Alder managed to convince her that she wasn't directly in danger, for now. He told her she had been rescued from the Inquisition by Dungeon Lord Edward Wright, and that an offer of minionship may be on the table if she behaved. That didn't put her at ease, but at least it got her to stop snarling.
So, Yaraz didn't survive the raid,
she said when Alder was done explaining. She flicked a golden lock away from her face.
Well, serves him right. I told him that leaving the Netherworld for this awful country was a bad idea.
Wasn't he, like, your mate or something?
Alder asked, unable to stop himself. Her callousness had taken him by surprise. Yarlan gave him a dismissive glance and scoffed.
And?
She asked. There was no emotion in those dead eyes. No grief. No regret. Perhaps a hint of rage, but Alder's empathy talent easily let him know that most of that rage was directed at him and Ed, because they were keeping her captive. No. Uraz was dead, and that meant he was no longer of any use to her. So he may as well never have existed. Alder shuddered.
I don't like her either, Ed told him. But remember why we're doing this.
The bard went ahead with his questioning. After all, the faster he got it done with, the faster he'd be able to leave the chamber. It was too cold anyway. Yarlan's memories of the hero's attack were fuzzy. She recalled that the rogue had separated from the other heroes and had tried to sneak into Uraz's throne room while the others dealt with a shock detachment of Naga spellcasters. Yarlan had taken command of Uraz's personal guard and had ambushed the rogue while he dealt with a trapped section of the dungeon and fought off a bunch of acid slimes. Yarlan had been sure that her ploy had worked. The rogue had been overwhelmed, at first, but then the heroic cleric had broken ranks and headed to rescue the rogue while the warrior kept the Naga occupied. Yarlan had felt the burning pain of a holy spell striking against her back, and then the rogue's scimitars had flashed across her neck. After that, everything had gone dark. Her Heart of Mist talent had taken over, instantly turning incorporeal and flying straight back to her coffin.
And what about your condition?
Alder asked. He gestured at her current size with his free hand, careful not to drop the lens away from his face.
It must have been the fault of those damned Inquisitors,
Yarlan said through a snarl.
They cracked my coffin, so mist must have poured out before my body had a chance to regenerate. It'll take years before I'm back to normal. By the dark, I swear that when I get my hands on them, I'll drink them dry and then bathe in their innards while they are still alive and writhing.
Alder swallowed.
Yeah, it must have been them. Screw those guys.
The effect of her diminished form only added to her creepiness. She lacked even a tiny ounce of a child's innocence. She looked exactly like a small animated corpse dressed up with doll's clothes, but her facial expression was adult and cruel, and her lips parted a bit too much over her mouth, as if the skin was too tight to fit her skull.
Don't let her intimidate you, Ed told him. She's the one who should be scared.
But Alder could feel through their shared connection that Ed was unnerved as well, and he was trying to reassure himself as much as Alder.
Ask her about the heroes. In general, I mean. We need to know if she and Yuraz had faced them before. What are they?
Alder doubted she'd cooperate without first negotiating a minionship pact, but he asked her anyway. The vampire's golden eyebrows rose an inch, then she chuckled mirthlessly. Alder noted the way her eyes turned distant, calculating. Using his empathy talent to read her emptiness was almost as telling as if there had been something there in the first place.
I know who you are,
she said at last.
Lord Wraith, is it not? The Netherworld is hot with gossip about you, your lowness. The first otherworldly dungeon lord, summoning you with a move stolen straight from the Light's playbook. Some think it's a shameful display of desperation to bring a stranger to deal with our problems. They'd rather you go back whence you came. I'm not so sure myself.
She narrowed her eyes to slits.
How did you survive here? When Yeraz and I came to Staravos, we tried to contact you, forge an alliance, yet you refused to answer. Why?
Because you are murderous lunatics, Ed thought.
We're the ones asking the questions, Alder said.
I was more than twice your age before I became a vampire,
Yarlan told Alder.
I know all the tricks, kid. I want proof you won't destroy me afterward. I want a pact.
Ed had already discussed with him what to say if she asked for a pact.
Best I can do is a temporal offer, Alder said. We shall speak the truth to each other, and will respect the spirit of the pact as well as the letter. For the duration, we won't harm you, and you won't harm us. No escape attempts either.
The vampire's face was a gray mask. Again, Alder detected no emotions other than the constant undercurrent of anger. He had the eerie sensation that his empathy had misread her the first time around. She was angry because he was warm and alive, and she was cold and dead, and she wanted to take what he had and drink it all into her.
I see,
she intoned.
Interesting offer.
She shuffled closer to the lines of the magical circle.
But then again, why bother with all this wariness, Lord Wraith? As creatures of the dark, we are kindred spirits. We should be talking as equals, eager to join forces against the militant church. Just have your vessel break this flimsy circle. Step over its boundary, my darling, and we can have ourselves a merry chat.
An enticing, pale purple light shone out of her eyes as she spoke that last sentence. Alder could see the beam through the dirty lens. Its light was diffused, filtered somewhat by the enchantments in the glass, but the bard could now see how shoddy its craftsmanship had been. The magic unraveled as Yarlan's magic punched through with ease, to Alder's horror. Yarlan's words seemed coated in honey as they reached his ears. They echoed inside his head, warm and lovely like the lullabies his mother sang to him when he was a baby in the cradle.
Alder? Nothing in the world would be more lovely than following Yarlan's gentle suggestion.
And she was right, anyway. Why would they distrust a potential ally as powerful as her? She could do so much for the hunt. If only they showed her the tiniest bit of confidence.
Alder, don't listen to her.
Alder took a step toward the circle. Yarlan's eyes widened with anticipation, a smirk drawing on her face as her hands extended to embrace him warmly as soon as he was over the boundary, and he was almost there, his feet hovering an inch behind the limit of the circle, with all his weight set to finish that step. And he was yanked out of his body by a black roaring cloud inside his head, violently shoved into some backward basement inside his own mind. As soon as he'd lost control of his body, his common sense had returned, as soon as he'd hit the basement's floorboards. He was horrified with himself, and at what had been about to happen. He watched through two distant holes of light, almost in slow motion, as his leg passed the boundary of the magical circle, carried by his own body's forward momentum. What he'd thought of as a small step had been practically a leap. Alder saw how the little undead monster hissed with pleasure and hunger and flung herself at the dungeon lord. At Alder, as fast as a blink, her claws aimed straight at his eyes. Alder screamed as the shadow of the vampire covered his face. And he saw how Ed used the very same weight of the leap to drive himself forward in one single fluid motion, then punched Yarlin straight in the mouth. Yarlin's tiny frame flew backward and smashed against the table of her coffin with a sharp crack, looking more confused than hurt. Ed almost thought that the coffin would fall on her, and he felt compelled to let it. But the thing didn't move at all, which in hindsight made sense. He didn't have superhuman strength, after all, and the vampire didn't weigh enough to shake the table much. Ed stepped away from the circle and threw a quick glance behind him, just as Kes flung the door open, sword drawn.
"Keep back," he told her. "It's under control."
"Like hell it is,"
the marshal snapped. Kleck was right behind her, dual-wielding a pair of stakes that looked like miniature spears in his small hands. Ed realized that the Batblin and the vampire were about the same size. The vampire cursed an ancient Lothian. Ed could have bet that she was insulting Alita's genitals in luxurious detail.
"In my true form, I would have torn that arm out of its socket,"
she said matter-of-factly.
"Even cursed, I'm stronger than this vessel you inhabit, Lord Wraith."
She almost sounded like a child whining, but that inhuman face left no room for doubt. Ed waved his friends away. He wasn't willing to risk them getting hypnotized, since he didn't know how fast Yarlin could spam the damn ability. Alder and he were the safest ones in the room anyway. If Alder failed a mental test, Ed had a chance to pass it himself, which had been exactly what had happened.
"You may be a rank stronger," Ed told Yarlin, "but you still are a fraction of his weight."
His hand, Alder's actually, pulsated painfully after the strike, and perhaps there was a cracked knuckle somewhere, and even then Ed had only pushed the vampire away. Yarlin wasn't hurt at all, despite him having struck her as hard as he could. Near the door, Kes stared daggers in the general direction of the magical circle. Ed waved at her again. "It's fine," he told her with a look. Kleck looked confused. He made small stabbing motions with his stakes, giving Ed a meaningful glance.
"I'll let you know if it comes to that," Ed reassured him.
Reluctantly, Kleck lowered his stakes. The marshal and the spider rider left the chamber and closed the door behind them. Yarlin cursed again, then straightened and seemed to calm himself in the blink of an eye.
"Well, I had to try it. It almost worked, though,"
she said.
"I should kill you for that," Ed told her, trying to mirror her calmness.
She unnerved him much more than he'd like Alder to know. A dead body, gray and cold, yet still animated and able to move with a fluidity and grace that rivaled that of any living being. It was unnatural. Orders of magnitude worse than a zombie. Almost as bad as a wraith. Perhaps he ought to leave and collapse the ceiling on her and her coffin, then set the splinters on fire afterward. For good measure. Let her try to survive that. But he had risked his life and the lives of his friends to get the creature to the haunt. He couldn't just let that effort go to waste.
"For what? Trying to defend myself against an obvious trick? A temporal pact? What a joke. There were no guarantees you'd let me go when you were done questioning me. And you don't seem that enthused about my services, Lord Wraith, which is frankly baffling. Given the incredible powers I could set at your disposal, maybe you desired a demonstration of my capabilities. Was I right? Are you satisfied with my little demonstration? The hypnotic gaze is only a small taste of what I can do, of the ruin I can bring upon your enemies."
"And little good it did you against the heroes," Ed said pointedly. "No, Yarlin, you have it wrong. A prisoner gets no say in the terms of their imprisonment. My temporal pact gives you no guarantees I won't kill you, but I can simply kill you without it anyway. What you're getting is one single chance to prove your worth, on my terms."
He raised three fingers.
"First, you'll show me your character sheet. No more surprises. Second, you'll tell me all you know about the heroes. How to fight them. How to kill them. What are they made of? When did they appear? All of it. And last, you'll tell me of all the ugly deeds you've done as a vampire, so I can know what to expect of you. And to know if I should kill you outright, if you turn out to be as monstrous as you appear, he thought. Do all that, and then we can talk about minionship.
Yarlan's eyes seemed like two embers of fury in her tiny, dead face framed by golden curtains.
At least you speak your mind, Dungeon Lord. But you're ignoring one small detail. I'm worth nothing to you if I'm destroyed. On the contrary, I've friends in the Netherworld willing to pay a nifty price for my release. I doubt you'll simply get rid of me if I refuse to speak.
She crossed her arms and smiled at him.
Leave me imprisoned if you wish. I wonder how long it'll take for you to come back, begging to take me in, while the militant church pounds at your doors.
Ed made his hand into a frustrated fist. She was right. He couldn't just kill her outright, not without figuring out what she knew. And he was on a literal deadline. Every day, the hero's attention neared Hoya, and the scramblers wouldn't keep them away indefinitely. But was he willing to let what was very possibly a psychopathic mass murderer, or worse, into the haunt, just because he had a use for her? Wasn't that exactly what the Lothian Dungeon Lords did? Recruit inhuman monsters that were willing to go to lengths any decent being would outright refuse?
Call her out, Alder thought at him.
I can't, Ed thought back, sharing all his doubts through their mental connection. If she stands her ground afterward, I'll lose all leverage if I don't follow through.
The bard performed the disembodied equivalent of shaking his head no.
Trust me on this one, Ed. This is what I'm good at. You called her a psychopath. I think I know what you mean by that. You're saying she cares for nothing and no one. Except you're wrong on one thing. She cares about herself. This will work. Trust me.
Ed took a deep breath and made his choice.
Well, sad to see this was all a waste of time, he said aloud. He didn't need to fake the twinge of annoyance in his words. Without looking at Yarlan, he snapped his fingers and two drones appeared in front of him with small puffs of smoke.
Our negotiations with our guest failed before they began, he announced. Gather firewood and collapse all exits. I want this chamber burnt to a crisp come daylight.
The vampire huffed.
Bah!
And smacked her dry blue lips. The two drones snapped to attention and threw malicious glares at the magical circle as they talked among themselves in their unintelligible language.
Ed turned to leave. For a moment, the only sound in the room came from the drone's chatter and his boots clanking against the stone floor. Fuck it, he thought as he walked away. There are other dungeon lords around. Perhaps they'll cooperate. He was reaching for the heavy, reinforced door when he heard the vampire stomp on the ground.
Wait!
She exclaimed, a twinge of desperation in her voice. Ed grabbed the handle and pushed the door open. Light from the hallway's torches flooded the chamber.
Lord Wraith, wait!
The twinge carried a pinch of hysteria now.
It was all a mistake! I was just testing your mettle!
Ed stepped out of the chamber, barring the door hard enough for the vampire to hear it. Ed let his drones pile firewood around the magical circle for an hour, with the vampire's cries bouncing around the rocks of the dungeon. In the meantime, he returned to his own body back in Zachary's quarters, which the priest had helpfully vacated. The Batblin cooks brought a cart with dinner for him and his friends while they rested and let their nerves settle. It had been a long night. Ed was sure that, if he closed his eyes, he could see the glow from Galio's sun wave coming his way, and could almost feel the heat prickling his skin. He nibbled on some buttered toast and downed it with long gulps of goat milk, which was creamy and slightly sweeter than cow milk. He handed Kleck a honey jar, into which the Batblin's snout disappeared for several minutes. Outside, in the mortuary, Yarlan kicked and screamed as the drones piled wood around her. Kes munched on fistful after fistful of nuts and talked about what she'd do to Zachary and Brett for giving them a faulty lens. Yarlin pleaded and smacked herself against the invisible barrier of the magical circle, the distinct crackle of energy reaching Ed's ears as clear as day. Levy sat in a corner, unwilling to get anywhere near Zachary's unkempt bed. She seemed to be in a terrible mood, and only spoke once to make sure everyone knew that nightshades were supposed to be better than the one in the mortuary, and that Yarlin was probably a mistake of some kind, and perhaps they could try to enter the Netherworld and try to recruit another one? Preferably an adult male, was the unspoken sentence on her lips. She crossed her arms and pouted. Everyone else shifted uncomfortably and tried their best to think about anything other than the witch's tastes, except for Kleck, who was too busy with his jar of honey to pay attention anyway. Alder ate little and drank much, his hands shaking a bit. The experience of almost having been siphoned dry had clearly rattled him, but the bard recovered surprisingly fast. It wasn't his first brush with death. Soon enough, he was regaling everyone with the tale of his front row experience to how Ed had punched an undead toddler so hard it vaulted into the air and almost landed back into its coffin. Alder looked more than a little tempted to alter his tale a bit in later retellings and add that last little detail in. All right, Ed said, after everyone was full and had rested a bit. He could sense his drones piling firewood past the hallway. Yarlin had stopped shouting and was now sitting atop her coffin, brooding. It was the small hours of the night, somewhere between 1 and 3 a.m. back in the world that had working clocks. I think that's enough of a timeout for her to get the point. He had a single horned spider enter the mortuary. Her name was Saffron, one of Kleck's own. Ed hitched a ride inside her mind just in case, using another casting of Murmur's Reach, but this proved unnecessary. Yarlin accepted Ed's temporal pact as soon as the offer left Saffron's mandibles.
Chapter 14. The Inquisitor's Dilemma. The mid-afternoon sunlight streamed into the hall, breaking into myriad beams as it came into contact with the fractal crystal panels that composed the ceiling and bathing everything with a dance of rainbow dots. The light shone on the examiner's silver-padded shoulders, the marble table in front, the plate armor of the inquisitors guarding the exit, the sober plants that hung from clay vases up the walls, and straight into Inquisitor Gallio's eyes. Gallio squinted and fought back the need to cover his face. Symbolism like that wouldn't escape the examiners. The forlorn inquisitor, blinded by the light, and turning his back from it. It was the reason they'd chosen to conduct the examination at this time of day, with the sun at their backs. That was very much the examiner's modus operandi. Why trust the goddess to provide meaning when it was faster to manufacture it?
Remind me, Inquisitor, how many men were under your command?
Prodded Examiner Harmon, his minotaur size bent over the tiny carved chair to an almost comical effect.
30 Inquisitors, Eminence, not counting the church's personnel led by Master Enric,
Gallio said.
Examiner Harmon was a 60-something human male, with a long, braided mane of gray hair falling over his shoulder and hiding the long scar that snaked through his neck and cheek. A trophy from the Staravosi campaign. Harmon was a war hero, a by-the-rulebook kind of man, someone who would have a kid whipped senseless if the child dared pocket an apple from a market stand. He let no sin go unpunished, which in turn made him the perfect examiner. And it also gave him a chip on his shoulder against Gallio, the black sheep who had returned to the flock after, famously, refusing to follow a direct command from a superior inquisitor.
And you still allowed yourself to be defeated by a bunch of spiderlings?
Asked Harmon. Gallio could imagine the frown in the man's tanned forehead, but he couldn't see it. The sunlight turned Harmon into a burning silhouette, impossible to gaze at, almost as if he were Alita's unrelenting truth made flesh. Which was probably the entire point. Gallio tried not to grind his teeth.
It was a Dungeon Lord's ambush, Eminence, he said. And we defeated it. A total victory, with no losses for our side and only a few wounded. On the other hand, the Dungeon Lord lost most of the horned spider cluster and was almost killed during the encounter.
He didn't mention that it had been his own sunwave which had dropped Edward Wright, although Gallio was still unsure of how that was possible. He could have misjudged the distance through the confusion of the moment, but was sure Edward should have been safe.
"Is that what you call a total victory?"
asked a woman's voice, barely bothering to hide the derision in her voice. Gallio turned to the bony silhouette next to Harmon's, that of Examiner Barthony.
"You kill a bunch of horned spiders. Not exactly a difficult feat for a devoted servant of the light. Yet you fail to strike any blow of consequence. The cluster's queen got away, and so did the Dungeon Lord. And they even managed to escape with the assets from Yraza's dungeon. Hardly what I'd call a victory."
Gallio blinked and took a deep breath to steady his temper. He probably failed an internal spirit test, because he could sense his blood boil.
"With all due respect, Eminence, we did all we could with the resources at hand. I had to make the call between protecting our non-combatants, which included Master Enric himself, or protecting the hero's plunder. Perhaps we should consult the scripture to see what Alita would think of my decision, although I do think that protecting the innocent ranks pretty highly in her mind."
"You forget your place, Inquisitor,"
Barthony said venomously.
"You are the one under examination, not us, nor our knowledge of the sacred tenets."
Barthony was Harmon's second in command, although not officially, since the examiners were supposed to be three equals. She was tall, thin, and severe, all sharp lines and disapproving eyes. She was King Varen's aunt-in-law, and this alone ensured that she'd make Archbishop before long, if she played her cards right. Pacifying Starevos would greatly hasten her advancement.
"Examiner Barthony is correct," said Examiner Hatter,
the third and last member of that day's ugly meeting. Hatter was a portly, red-headed elf with just a dash of gnomish blood somewhere in his family tree. The combination gave him an affinity to magic, and he was an accomplished wizard by his own right. He had a big, round nose and bright gnome-pink eyes that shone with arcane power. He also stank of stale wine and moldy cheese, and was probably drunk up to his ears if only because "Examiner Barthony is correct" seemed to be the only words he could utter for the duration of the meeting. Barthony shot an openly hostile glance at Hatter, then went on.
"And since you so helpfully brought up the sacred tenets, Inquisitor Gallio, let me remind you that root out evil anywhere it takes hold is Alita's main commandment to her devoted. Protect the innocent is a fine and proper moral aspiration, but it's a subordinate tenet, since the only sure way to protect the innocent is to destroy evil forever, no matter how difficult or costly. This is, quite possibly, the most important lesson an Inquisitor may learn."
"A lesson which you failed,"
said Examiner Harmon, rattling his fingers on the long marble table.
"Even when the Militant Church kindly sent you to Starevos as a chance for you to come to this realization on your own."
Gallio straightened his back.
"Eminences, with all due respect..."
"You keep saying that,"
snapped Barthony.
"Apparently you think it replaces showing some respect."
"With all due respect,"
Gallio repeated through a clenched jaw,
"our detachment was undermanned since the start. We've been walking blindly through Dungeon Lord lands for months on end, with no aerial support, barely any runes, and shoddy magical weaponry. This ambush, or something like it, was bound to happen. As such, I believe it was payback for Yraza's defeat. We were lucky it wasn't worse."
He couldn't avoid the resentment coming through his voice. It had been Harmon's call to send Gallio's detachment without even a single griffin. This was the reason Gallio was happy to remain a lowly field agent of the Inquisition while the examiners, bishops, and archbishops played at their games. Politics muddled what should have been simple. Destroy evil. Protect the innocent.
kill the Dark's servants. But it was also the reason the examiners could toy with him like he was a straw doll in the hands of a child, or like Murmur toying with a stranger from another world.
"Enough,"
said Examiner Harmon, his cruel eyes barely visible under the great bulk of his face.
"We've heard enough. You came here to make yourself responsible for your mistakes, like befitting someone of your rank, Inquisitor."
Harmon's scar turned a shade of purple.
"And because of that, the examiner heads of the Inquisition dictate that you should be stripped of command until, and if, you prove yourself worthy."
Gallio lowered his head. He'd seen the decision coming for a while now. Harmon had only been looking for an excuse, and eventually he would find one. But still, the demotion hurt. It was like suddenly being stripped of his clothes and cast out into the cold. It reminded him of his exile and the way the other Inquisitors had looked at him when he'd boarded the ship that brought him to Starevos. No longer important enough for the Inquisition to spare the cost of having him step through a portal. He wondered if the guards behind him would look at him the same way those others had back in Haleges.
"Probably not," he decided.
After all, this time, he was still an Inquisitor. He could still cast a sun wave, a feat that only a chosen few could perform, regardless of their ranking. It was Alita herself that decided who held her blessing, not Harmon or any archbishop, no matter how much they'd love to think they did. He let himself drop to one knee and saluted the examiners.
"As you command, I shall face this punishment and learn this lesson you've set for me."
He held Harmon's gaze, letting him know he wasn't defeated.
"We are not done yet,"
said Barthony, clicking her tongue. She nodded to the guards behind Gallio, and one of them hurried outside.
"Command of the Hoya Inquiry is to pass under a new Inquisitor, one appointed by us. You'll remain in his service and follow his orders with the respect due to a superior officer. You're on thin ice, Inquisitor Gallio. One more failure, and I doubt Alita herself will welcome you back into the fold."
Examiner Hatter sighed, then gave a wet burp and massaged his belly.
"She's right, you know,"
he told Gallio with a sad nod. Barthony's eyes widened with disgust. It looked like she had been close enough to Hatter to taste that burp. Gallio decided that maybe he liked Hatter after all. The clanking of metal alerted Gallio of the guard's return. Inquisitor Oak, the stiff, tall kid under Gallio's command, followed the man. Oak gave Gallio an ashamed nod. Gallio returned it, albeit confusedly. What was Oak doing here?
"Inquisitor Oak is, as of now, the new commander of the Hoya Inquiry,"
announced Examiner Harmon, as if he was emitting a divine verdict from his tall chair. Gallio's mouth parted in disbelief.
"Oak?"
he asked, almost as if speaking to himself.
"But he's too young! He will only get himself killed!"
Oak's ashamed expression turned sour, his cheeks flushing.
"I'm as capable as any, I assure you."
Gallio cursed inwardly. Through his carelessness, he'd lost what little goodwill Oak had for him.
"You don't understand,"
he began, trying to fix his mistake.
"They want to set you up,"
he thought desperately.
"You have never faced a dungeon lord before. You don't know what that's like."
"Our decision is final," said Harmon.
"Unless you wish to hang up your sword in return to Haleges,"
Barthony said.
"We could have a merchant ship ready for you this very night, ready for free passage back home."
She smiled with fake kindness, like she'd made him an offer too good for him. Gallio's insides twisted with anger.
"That won't be necessary, Eminence,"
he told her. He looked straight at the silhouettes of the three, Harmon's bulk, Barthony's rigid posture, and Hatter's ample chin resting on a bored fist.
"Am I free to go?"
Harmon waved at the door with a careless gesture.
"You are dismissed. Inquisitor Oak, Remain with us for a bit longer, if you please. We must discuss your new responsibilities."
Gallio saluted, although no one was looking at him any longer, as if he'd dropped from reality after they were done with him. And in a way, for people like them, he truly had disappeared. He had been a small, unseemly stain in their orderly organization, so they'd simply reached down and flicked him away like one might a fly. He missed Barova. It was a lonely walk out into the open exterior corridor over the mansion's garden, then down a long spiral staircase with burnished brass handrails. The steps were made of beautiful white stone infused with black veins and flecks of silver. Stepping down the stairs into the garden was like coming down from the Argent Plain into primal Ivalis below, just as it was before the light came and issued order and warmth into wildlife in the times before the Age of Myths. Gallio had once walked among the gardens of Sildel, the royal stronghold, back when he'd taken the Inquisitor's oath for the first time. The pledging was a special occasion, a yearly event where the militant church presented its best acolytes to the king and the good people of Haleges so that they could learn the faces of their future protectors. King Varen himself had cast his golden sword over Gallio's shoulder and given him his blessing, his steel-gray eyes shining silver under the Haligian blue skies. Gallio could recall many details about that day. 5-year-old Prince Varen hiding in his mother's skirts and chewing thoughtfully on a wooden toy, the soft whispering of the fountains mixing with the song of the garden's cicadas, and the pride in his own chest threatening to burst out like a balloon. Becoming an inquisitor had been his lifelong dream. The militant church took on many children, but few were suited to take the oath. Those who were worthy became the people's protectors, defenders of the light, a bulwark against the encroaching darkness that threatened to drown good and beauty everywhere. Gallio wasn't sure when the Harmons and the Barthanys of the Inquisition had drowned his childhood ideals with their scheming and plotting, but it had been long before his exile. Today, he recalled something else about that day. When compared with Sildel's ordered rows of carefully trimmed flowery mead, its orchards with their golden and red apples, and its dovecotes of white pigeons, this mansion's garden was as wild and shoddy as a Kufdar's cottage. Apparently, the gardeners of Mulesius Street had a fundamental disagreement with those of Sildel about what made up a tasteful trim, because every noble house and mansion preferred this unkempt style. The Starovosi nobility's architecture was rough on the outside, naked stone and iron fences contrasted against an opulent interior, with open stone corridors surrounding a jungle of a garden. Wild plexian cushions tall enough to hide a lion fought for sunlight against pink caladiums and palm trees from distant shores of places whose names Gallio knew only from bardic tales. On Mulesius Street, seemingly the only function of gardeners was to ensure the plants didn't kill each other or poison the soil. According to Alvidra, who knew more of plants and soil than he ever would, Constantina's air was so salty that the fact the nobility and the merchants managed to maintain any kind of exotic gardens at all was proof enough of their riches. Gallio suspected there was something to be gleaned from the contrast between these two gardens he'd encountered at very different times in his life, and his mixed feelings about his role as an inquisitor. But he wasn't in the mood for deep realizations. What he really wanted was to go back in time, find Ione, Kes, and Alvidra, and go achieve the fabled, advanced drunkenness status that Maria insisted her brew could deliver like no other in all of Ivalis. Maria's tavern had burned to the ground, just like his former life. Gallio found his last remaining friend waiting for him by the garden's fish pond. Alvidra was wearing her civilian outfit, a white cotton shirt buttoned up to her neck with long sleeves that hid her wrists, linen pants, and sandals. Her eyes were bloodshot and her step unsure. Despite the clerics clearing away her poison, whatever those Kufdar had used to put her down had struck her like a mace to the head. Even days after the ambush, she was still showing the after effects.
"You look like dung,"
Alvidra told him as he approached.
"If you need some sleep, I found a concoction that works like a charm. You should try it."
She grinned, and for an instant she was back to being the freckled ranger apprentice under Ione's tutelage, madly stricken with the broody avian mercenary that had arrived in Barova looking for work.
"I may take you up on that," Gallio said.
Alvedra was tossing bread from a cloth bag into the pond to the delight of a school of dish-shaped rainbow-colored fish. Gallio stepped next to her and watched the fish fight amongst themselves for every tiny piece.
"The examination didn't go well, did it?"
Alvedra said after a while.
"And where did you get that impression?" Gallio asked.
"For starters, you keep looking at my fish like you want to sunwave them."
Gallio blinked, then brandished a stern finger at her.
"Don't be silly. The sunwave is meant only for the enemies of the light. Although,"
he narrowed his eyes at the pond,
"those fish do seem a bit suspicious. I wonder if they've paid their tithes lately."
Alvedra barked a laugh.
"Just say the word and I'll go gather firewood for the pyre."
She tossed a handful of bread at the fish, then pocketed the bag and turned to Gallio.
"So, what happened?"
"Well, it turns out I'm no longer your superior officer."
He told her the rest in broad strokes, trying to keep his personal feelings about the examiners out of it. She was still his apprentice, after all. By the end, not even years of martial discipline could keep his shoulders from slumping a bit.
"There has to be a mistake,"
Alvedra said after he was done.
"The ambush clearly wasn't your fault. Why would the examiners act like that?"
She stroked her chin and pursed her lips in frustration.
"We're all on the same side."
Gallio shook his head.
"That's the problem. An examiner is really an inquisitor's inquisitor. They're technically outside our order, but since they only answer to the archbishops, they're free to do as they wish."
The militant church's hierarchy was relatively straightforward. It had three branches. The church dealt with the congregation of the light, the teaching of the holy tenets, and the spread of the religion across Ivalis. The militant part meant that, in cases of war, it was the duty of the church to summon and lead the armies of Haligis. And finally, there was the Inquisition, whose sworn mission was to look deep into the hearts of men and destroy the evil they found there, one way or the other, in order to stop the corruption of the dark from taking over the world. The leaders of the militant church were, in descending order of importance, Alita herself, her seven holy consorts, her holy avatar, which hadn't incarnated in centuries, and then the minor light gods in an awkward sort of revered elder position. After the divine came the mortal leaders. The king was first, in theory. Then, at the same level of authority were the archbishops, leading the militant church on the day-to-day, the supreme inquisitors, and the knight generals who commanded the Haligian army. The examiners were inquisitors, but their duty was to ensure the integrity of the Inquisition itself and to protect it from dark corruption. They didn't answer to the supreme inquisitors, but to the archbishops, and were hand-selected from their positions in the other two branches. Harmon, for example, had been a knight captain, then a member of the royal guard before his summon, and Barthony had been a bishop.
"Then you should write to the archbishops,"
Alvedra said.
"Present your case to them. They're the best of us, aren't they? Surely they'll see that the examiner's got a bit overzealous."
Gallio grinned mirthlessly. It was strange seeing how someone as grizzled and street-smart as Alvedra could be so naive in some matters. But could he blame her? He had trained her in the ways of the light. She saw the militant church as how it should be, instead of how it actually was. Who was in the wrong? Despite her age, Alvedra had succeeded the trials of the Inquisition, her training as a ranger speeding her along the initiation and basic training, and her devotion earning her the favor of Alita herself. Perhaps she'd be casting sun waves before long. It was clear that the light rewarded devotion. The only question left was why Gallio himself was worthy of the sun wave.
"Let's consider this a test of my faith," Gallio said. "If Alita's design provides for me being a leader, then it shall be so. In the meantime, we should focus on keeping Oak alive."
Alvedra nodded, relieved. They walked together through the garden, letting the aroma of flowers and wet grass relax their bodies and minds. There was no stench of fish in any home of Mulesia Street.
"There's one more thing we need to discuss," Gallio said after a while. "But first, let's drop the Inquisitor mantle for a while, Alvidra. Let's speak as friends."
Alvidra read his intentions instantly.
"Gallio!"
"Yes,"
Gallio said. Alvidra winced as if someone had brandished a knife in her face.
"We haven't talked about what happened since the clerics cleansed you."
"To be honest, I came searching for you to talk about something else. I was hoping you'd forget about this."
"Really?"
"Well, I know it was foolish. That's why I called it Hope."
They reached a small bird fountain made of granite. There was a sculpture atop the fountain, representing some Sterevosi pagan god. Possibly a spirit of harvest, judging by the size of its breasts, but there was no way of knowing. The head was missing, probably smashed by some overzealous inquisitor. Alvidra spoke first.
"I'm sorry for leaving on my own during the battle. I let my temper get the better of me, and it forced you to rush in without reinforcements. I could have gotten you killed."
"Look, if I had an aureus for every time I lost my temper and did something stupid, Oinus himself would have turned me into his avatar long ago."
That got Alvidra to smile and roll her eyes, which had been the point.
"I'm worried about you, Al, not about your tactical mistakes. Seeing Kes like this, out of nowhere, must have been hard."
"It was for me,"
Gallio thought, recalling his encounter with Ed. The Dungeon Lord had changed from a young man, almost a kid, really, into a barely recognizable warrior. With his face hidden by his helmet and that cape masking his proportions, it may have been any Dungeon Lord in that forest. But the voice had left no room for doubts.
"That's my point, I guess,"
Alvidra said. She strolled to the bird fountain and rummaged through her pockets until she found a second bag, this one full of birdseed, which she used to restock the fountain's brass plate. Gallio wondered if she just carried bags of seed with her all day.
"I shouldn't have lost my temper. What happened to Kes? I fought with myself so long over it, you know? At first, I didn't want to believe it. It had to be some kind of mistake. A ruse. I figured Kes would kill the Dungeon Lord when she had the chance. Then she'd hide somewhere. Can I tell you a secret? If she had killed the Dungeon Lord, I mean, I wouldn't have chased her. I know that destroying the minions of the dark is our duty and all, but..."
She shrugged and made her hands into fists, visibly fighting tears.
"God damn it!"
Gallio shuffled next to his friend and hugged her. Dealing with displays of emotion other than zealous rage wasn't something they taught kids in the convent, which meant that the way most inquisitors dealt with emotions was by repressing them for decades until something cracked and they heard voices or screaming in their sleep.
"There, there,"
he said lamely. Alvidra hid her face underneath her hands and took a deep breath. Then she brushed her cropped hair away from her forehead, a reflex from when it had been longer.
"There, there."
A very tiny grin curled on her lip.
"Really?"
"Don't judge. Charm is my lowest stat."
Her grin grew a quarter of an inch. Gallio nodded with satisfaction. Humor was the multi-purpose weapon of the emotionally stunted, and he brandished it as fiercely as he would a sword if his back were against the wall.
"That person we found in the forest wasn't Kes,"
Alvidra said quietly, out of nowhere. She crossed her arms and glanced at the blue sky.
"I know that now. Denial, anger, blaming myself. All those are parts of grieving. Like the priests say, I was mourning her loss, because she died when she pacted with the Dungeon Lord. Even if her body is still there, acting and speaking like she would have. Do you understand?"
When she faced Gallio, there was a glint of vengeful fire in her eye.
"There are so many tales of evil creatures taking the shape of the ones we love and pretending to be them. Changelings, Safar's Bane, high elves switching human children for their own. I decided that a Dungeon Lord's pact is much the same thing, If you don't reject the dark, it consumes you. Tess is gone, and if I wish to avenge her, I must destroy the lord that took her. Perhaps then, if I free her soul, Alita will allow her entrance into the afterlife.